Welcome to the Penn Faulkner Podcast, a monthly podcast showcasing author events from our annual reading series, as well as occasional clips from our archives. This month we have audio from the 2011 Penn Malamud Award reading, recorded live at the Folger Elizabethan Theater in December of last year. This year's recipient of the award is Edith Perlman, who is introduced by Susan Richard Shreve, co-chairman of the Penn Faulkner Board of Directors. Edith Perlman is presented the award by Jana Malamud Smith. The Penn Faulkner podcast series is made possible by the generous support of Amazon.com and is co-sponsored by the Folger Shakespeare Library. If you'd like to learn more about the Penn Faulkner Foundation, visit us online at www.pennfaulkner.org.
Race through town to the Folger. We welcome with delight Edith Perlman, winner of the 2011 Penn Malamud Award for Excellence in the Short Story, an award given not for a single collection of stories, but for a continuing and distinguished career from book to book, publication to publication. I want to welcome as well the Malamud family, as we do every year. In December, it feels like our family. Jana Malamud Smith, his daughter, Paul Malamud, his son, Peter Smith, his grandson, and David Smith, his son-in-law. In honoring the precision and generosity of Edith Perlman's stories, we honor as well the lifetime achievement of Bernard Malamud, for whom the sentence was in itself a work of art. "I'm slow," Edith Perlman says of herself. "A sentence often takes an hour to compose before I throw it out." What can you do? Perlman is a writer with her own internal camera, curious, compassionate, wry, writing out of the world she observes, the travels she takes, small bits of life which come together through her imaginings, creating stories which reflect, among so much else, something like the wonder at us all. Binocular Vision, the name of the collection of new and collected and selected stories, is defined as vision in which two eyes are used with overlapping fields of view, allowing perception of depth. In the story, Binocular Vision, a 10-year-old girl finds her physician father's binoculars and with them projects herself into the living room of the Simons, who live in the apartment next door. She watches the couple regularly, room to room, except their bedroom, which is large and dark, and the front hall, which she cannot see. Watches Mr. Simon return home and park in the garage. Watches them in the living room, Mr. Simon reading the newspaper, Mrs. Simon talking and talking at him. Then one morning, at breakfast, when she has begun to lose interest in the Simons, the police arrive, summoning her physician father to the apartment next door, where Mr. Simon is dead. But that is not the end of the story, nor did the little girl know exactly what she was looking at just by watching. Earlier, I used the word delight, which describes this reader's joy in Edith Perlman's stories. Spare, elegant, detached in a way that allows us the unencumbered freedom to enter the mystery of her fictional landscapes. And here is the delight. These stories are optimistic, a word infrequently applied to modern fiction. And their sense of possibility comes of independent-minded characters, often in difficult circumstances, who prevail, like those in Purim Night, in a displaced persons camp in 1947 Germany, whose marvelous imagination creates for them a wonderful celebration of the holiday. Or the unlikely couple in Girl in Blue with Brown Bag, the man 67, the girl 17, whose love for one another comes of conversation. Accommodation, Edith Perlman has said, is my favorite theme. And in reading Perlman's stories, their range in humor and simplicity, the aftertaste is one of hope that comes of flexibility, an open eye, a sense of order, that of art and of morality. In maybe her most daring story in this collection, Self-Reliance, Cornelia Fitch, a retired gastroenterologist, receives a second diagnosis of cancer and chooses not to treat it. How this story is finally triumphant. How, through the beauty of her language, Perlman comes to an astonishing conclusion that leaves us with a sense of rightness about the life of Cornelia Fitch, is what Malamud says of art, that it celebrates life and gives us our measure. Edith Perlman.
Thank you. Thank you, Susan. I am bursting with thanks, and I want to give them before I read. I'm reversing the usual convention of giving thanks after the award. I'm going to give them before the award. I can hear my mother very cautiously saying, "Keep your mouth shut. They can still change their minds." But I'll take a chance. Thank you, Susan, as I said. It is such a sweet moment for me to receive the prize I most crave, the prize which elevates the short story, a genre so often overlooked, and which elevates me into an extremely select group. I feel enormously grateful to the Penn Faulkner Foundation, to the Malamud Awards Committee. Thank you all. To pile up the pleasures, the prize is named for one of my all-time favorite writers, who, by example, taught me compression, gave me leave to mix the fantastic and the realistic, and demonstrated to me the value of the enigmatic. Thanks to Bernard Malamud for bequeathing to all of us his splendid work. Thanks to the Malamud Foundation, and in advance to JAMA. As for the individuals who have supported me for decades, husband, children, daughter-in-law, sister, how I love you, how grateful I am. Thanks, too, to my grandson, Jojo. We have a running collaboration on a children's story, The Adventures of Grandma Bug and Jojo Bug. It is compressed, fantastic, and enigmatic. Thanks to my longtime friend, agent, and champion, Jill Nero. And to the coordinators of this event, Matt Barisi, Emma Snyder, and Mike Scalise. This award is given for my stories so far, but it is my recent collection, Binocular Vision, which brought me to the public notice. Two bold young editors made this book happen, Ben George and Emily Smith. I don't see you, Emily, but I know you're here, and Emily Smith. They chose my work to launch their new imprint, Lookout Books. Emily is master of all that has to do with the creation of a beautiful book. Ben is a dream editor, willing to discuss everything from the meaning of a story to the distribution of its commas. Ann Patchett wrote a sublime introduction. I could not have had better friends in the production of this book. So thank you, Ben, Emily, Malamud's, Perlman's, the Awards Committee, and all the others. And finally, thanks to the three small presses who published my earlier collections, and the many little magazines who published my stories, and the equally numerous ones who turned them down. Little presses and little magazines are committed to keeping literature alive, and they deserve thanks from every writer, tonight particularly from me. Thank you all for being here. I'm going to read a story from Binocular Vision, which was mentioned by Susan. It's called Girl in Blue with Brown Bag. It takes about 20 minutes. It has two main characters, Frances Morrison, an elderly public servant, and Luann Zerubin, an unpolished teenage girl. There is also a dead French painter, Edouard Villard. Girl in Blue with Brown Bag. They had many things in common, the man of 67 and the girl of 17. They were both undersized. Their eyes were a similar light blue, though Frances's vision was excellent and Luann's was poor. She glared at the world through spectacles so thick they seemed opaque. They lived in mirror image apartments on the second floor of a double brownstone, Luann with her uncle and aunt, Frances alone. Both liked pastry, both favored backpacks. Frances's worn pack was almost empty nowadays. It held a book or two, the Morning Globe, the Systadane powder he had to mix with water. But the backpack was, he liked to think, his sartorial trademark. During the 40 years he'd served in the great and general court of Massachusetts, first in the House and then in the Senate, he disdained a briefcase. His pack had been full then. Luann's was full now. It bulged with high school textbooks. She was studying chemistry, calculus, English, French, and constitutional law. Constitutional law was a new and experimental course for gifted seniors. She had some trouble with it because it presumed a knowledge of American history. She had come from Moscow to this streetcar suburb as a sophomore. American history was offered only in the freshman year. "History is finished," she'd complained on a memorable afternoon last September. They'd met on the staircase, she coming home from school, he going out for a stroll. "What do you mean, Mrs. Zerubin?" "I mean that I never learned it and I can't take it now." And she explained further, "Call me Luann, Mr. Morrison." Her name was Luann, the way his was Edouard Villard. She'd snatched Luann from some country singer on TV. "All right, Luann, please call me..." "Oh, dear." "I'll call you Mr. Francis, Mr. Morrison." "Mr. Francis, aren't you sort of American history in your own person?" She was two steps below him. "I mean, thinking up laws all those years, you've only just retired, my uncle told me. And your ancestors were pilgrims. Didn't they sail on one of those ships?" "The Pinta." "I thought it had another name. Mr. Francis, could I come to you for instruction? It would be a privilege." He backed up a stair. "Oh, my dear, you see, my hobby, looking at paintings, it takes up too much of my time. I am a museum trustee. I serve on the acquisitions committee." "Once a week. I could come once a week." How long had she been planning this attack? "We get out at noon on Wednesdays." She moved up a stair and threw her backpack beside her feet. Now he couldn't descend without leaping over the pack. "You can assign texts. I'll read them. I'm thorough." He knew she was thorough. She was a thorough housekeeper. On Saturday mornings, her aunt left the apartment door open, as did Frances, honoring the unbuttoned quality of the day. And so he had seen Luann vacuuming on her knees, reaching her wand far underneath the sofa. She was thoroughly plain, ungroomed, unadorned, her wardrobe limited to jeans and denim jackets. "You can give quizzes." He had never seen her with a friend. But did his retirement really promise to be thoroughly fulfilling? Did he have so many friends? Instruction, Wednesday afternoons, it will be a privilege. And so began their modest tutorial, conducted mostly in Francis's living room. They were sitting there today, a cloudy March Wednesday, and sometimes at the museum, and sometimes at a nearby pond. They didn't adhere thoroughly to the original curriculum, the Constitution, the colonial period, but drifted into art and nature and even pedagogy. "I disapprove of yes or no questions," he said one day, handing her back a school test she'd shown him. "What's wrong with yes or no? You remember something or you don't. And if you don't, you get a 50% chance. A test is a teaching device. It should encourage the student to consider the uncategorical, the ambiguous." "Yeah." That frequent syllable meant God knows what. Sometimes their conversations strayed into the area of personal history. "You never got married," she remarked one afternoon with comradely spurning of tact. "Maybe you like men?" "I like women, and I like men, both at arm's length." He even liked homely, outspoken schoolgirls with an odd attachment to a motherland in ruins. On a different occasion, pausing near the pond, she told him she planned to go back to Russia after college. "And wouldn't you return to the country of your birthing?" "Birth," he said. She'd asked him to correct her errors. "I was born here," he said, unable to keep pride out of his voice. "Then you don't know exile. It's terra incognita." But she had no Latin, and he was obliged to explain the phrase. Today, while a sudden sun turned Francis's pale room paler, they were worrying the subject of representative government. "Didn't you ever lose an election in all that time?" she asked. "No, I never lost. But sometimes my opponents were obviously unfit. The Republicans like to put up somebody, anybody." "But people wanted you even when your opponent was not an asshole." "Why?" "I identify with the Commonwealth," he ventured. Then he continued, "I see the Commonwealth as an extension of myself, its public gardens my flower patch, its public libraries my bookshelves, its police my bodyguard, its ball team my..." He glanced at the 17th century map of Massachusetts over the sofa, a retirement gift from his colleagues. "Yeah, don't stop. It's ball team my sandlot, it's state hospitals my mad aunt." He was quoting himself, the curse of old age, but she didn't know that. "I believe that the family, variously defined, defined sometimes as one solitary celibate, is both the paradigm and the ward of the state. I believe that..." He did stop. "Luann, enough for now." "No. Tell me about your first Senate running." "Race. We'll take that up another day." "Okay, let's hit the museum." They gazed at the VR first, as always. The artist's mother sits in profile at a table, cutting out fabric. The fabric is a kind of plaid, her dress is a kind of check, the wallpaper is dotted with pears. Light from an unseen source catches the nape of Madame, her ear, the side of her jaw, her spectacles. It catches, too, a brass bowl and half of a covered dish. The light comes from behind the painter, or from the painter, or from the man and girl now standing in front of the work. "How natural it all looks," Francis said. "But a painting is an artificial work. It calls for as much cunning as the commission of a crime." "Those are not my words," he admitted. "The words of Monsieur Viard?" "The words of Monsieur Degas." "Also a bachelor who lived with his mother?" "No, he had a more active life." They moved away. The girl did not care for paintings of bourgeois characters in their parlors any more than she cared for workers' posters. He knew that because he knew what she did care for: frontal holy families, coy annunciations. Someday an angel might appear to her, announcing not love, nothing so ambitious, but perhaps, at last, friendship. They strolled and looked. Then, at the museum's cafe, they ate Napoleons. "I need strength," said Luann. She was off to meet her clients. Her clients were three American lawyers perfecting their conversational Russian, which was already excellent. They studied hard. They demanded to be taught slang. "They are up to no good," Francis had predicted. "Profiteers." "Yeah. They're already rich." Sometimes she conducted the class at the mansion of one of her clients. She had to take two buses to get there, but she got sent home in a taxi. "They want to be richer," Francis said. "Doesn't every citizen?" They said goodbye under an elm tree. Luann headed downtown to the office of her dubious clients. Francis crossed a city park, mauve in the early twilight. "My backyard," he exulted. Yet there were many things that they did not have in common, the retired legislator and the sojourner. Language facility, for instance. Luann spoke Russian, German, English, and rudimentary French. Francis, despite his schoolboy Latin and Greek, was monolingual. Health, for another example. His shortness was merely hereditary, and his heart condition gave him no discomfort. She was stunted, and her aunt knew nothing about nutrition. And politics. Luann sneered at the notion of equality. "So everyone gets a right to education? So teachers in slum schools give out A's for rap lyrics? And community colleges teach bus driver management? Democracy." She would have welcomed the return of the Romanovs. Still, how comfortable he had become at their Saturday dinners. The beef and barley stew, discs of fat decorating the surface. The salad, potatoes and sour cream. Its chopped scallion, the meal's one green vegetable. The henna'd aunt, her sweater one size too small. The bald, jowly uncle. The rancid light, an arthritic dog. The paintings, offerings in primary colors of magical events, all by the hand of a single untalented emigre. A religious reminder, the Giotto Madonna and child in a gilt frame. Francis thought of his beloved VR, and in his mind he moved this worthy family from its apartment, hung with faux Chagalls and one terrible reproduction of a masterpiece, into a room of patterns, sunlit through blinds. Everything would be tactile. The mustache of the man, the lipstick mouth of the woman, the spot of gravy on the denim cuff of the girl, who was teaching herself to use her left hand because, she said, she wanted to be ambiguous. Afterwards, uncle and niece played chess, and Mrs. Zerubin did needlework, and Francis and the dog watched the fire. How satisfying domestic life was when you could shut the door on it at the end of an evening and cross the hall and then shut a second door, your own. Another Wednesday, April now. They discussed love of money. De Tocqueville noticed it centuries ago. "You don't love money, Mr. Francis." "Well, you see, I have never been poor, and I don't care about fine clothes or travel." "So what do you care about? What are your transcendent values?" She was proud of the phrase. Her smirk told her him so. "Well, if he had to name something, the primary importance of loyalty, the relative importance of honesty." "Truth," he heard himself lying. "What else?" "Beauty," he helplessly admitted. "Personal beauty?" He nodded. It was a yes or no question. Her jaw hardened. And the beauty of a sycamore, and of a receding city street, and of a work of art, of course you know that, and the beauty of solitude. And a diamond? I could get you one. My aunt's cousin Kolya, the rascals, he knows. Jewels don't interest me. How had he allowed this interrogation to begin? Beauty, she repeated. I could get you that. What do you mean, Luann? You have already brought beauty into my life. He withstood her glare. The beauty of your extraordinary young mind and of our conversations? Yeah. 3 Wednesdays later, she came in carrying, by its strong handles, a big brown bag. She lowered the bag, pulled out something surrounded by a narrow frame, and set the something on the floor so that it leaned against the wall. It was perhaps 12 by 18 inches. It was the mother again, seen full face, an older face, shadowed, a face that might bend over a grandchild's cradle or the sickbed of an invalid. What she was bending over was a glass vase filled with daisies. The background suggested wallpaper. The painting was signed. I saw it weeks ago, said Luann, in that house. It was in some sort of guest bedroom just to the side of the bathroom. I opened the door, it's always closed, and I put on the light, and there it was. Luann. The house is full of stuff like this. They're loaded, those thugs. They buy things to wash money. You know that, Mr. Francis. In Russia, they get more loaded, like you said. As you said. As. So I took it yesterday because the guy's wife has left him and he's going to Moscow tomorrow and no one will know it's missing for weeks and then he'll think she... Luann. It wasn't just hanging there for anybody to grab. Don't think that. There was this security clasp I had to figure out. And the bag. That was no picnicking. I had to buy a scarf at Bloomie's and ask for the bag for the saleswoman and then return the scarf the next day and keep the bag. Luann, his chest hurt. She stood before him, sturdy as a guard, not quite his height. What? Personal property, it's a right, he thought. Thieving, it's a crime, he thought. There's a social compact, he thought. But she knew all that. She had memorized ethical principles the way she might have memorized a recipe for pie. Rules she could recite but would never practice, and he would not rebuke her. Loyalty was what counted most. He told her that, or meant to. Aren't you going to say anything? Thank you, he managed. The next day, he hung it in the living room over the fireplace. The portrait of his great-grandfather, once Attorney General of the Commonwealth, was relegated to the bedroom, replacing the mirror, which itself went into the back of the clothes closet, doubling his thrifty wardrobe. His great-grandfather, bearded, one hand resting on the laws of the Commonwealth, had thrown his noble gaze across the room towards the early map of Massachusetts. Portrait and map provided an axis of honor. The VR corrupted the room. Luann's glasses glinted at the painting on her first few visits after the bestowal. Then they didn't. Nowhere could he find news of the theft. The painting had probably been stolen to begin with. He could not identify it in the catalogue raisonné. Even under the heading privately held, he could not find Madame with flowers or anything like. Still, its most recent possessor must have noticed its absence by now. Perhaps the Russian mafia was making plans to kill him. Luann was still teaching those dirty lawyers. And the one in the grand house, if he should mention that he's been robbed, asked Francis. He hasn't. If he does, in which language? Oh, English. I'll say, speak Russian. In Russian, then. I look sympathetic. To demonstrate, she slanted her head and pursed the corners of her mouth, an executioner checking the knot on a noose. He loved the gift she'd given him. As time passed, he did not love it less. He did not get used to it, the woman's head so close that her voice could almost be heard, the economy of line and the limited palate, the lack of a grand idea, the humble daisies, a humble artist, secondary even in his heyday. Our judicial system was better than yours, she was saying one Wednesday. Judges were an extension of the little father and... Luann, my dear, we must relinquish the painting. Her glasses stared at him. I cherish it, he went on, but it is too much for me. I will die of it. You will die of a heart attack. Isn't that why you take that powdered stuff? The medicine is to prevent my dying. To delay it. Anyway, nobody ever died from beauty. Then I will be the first. Silence while she surveyed him. I've still got the brown bag, she admitted, but usually I teach those crooks at their office. I don't know when I'll be at their house again. We cannot return it to them, Luann. It demands a public place, a shared arena, a location where any person, moneyed or penniless, cultured or gross, passionate or indifferent, can benefit from its... Mr. Francis? He halted. With effortful simplicity, he said, it belongs at the museum. Oh, so donate it. Well, no, not with its murky provenance. He did not want her deported. We must slip it in. Like a bomb? Like a bomb. My great-great-uncle threw a bomb. They shot him for it, asshole. She was referring to her relative, he hoped. Good morning, Nick. Mr. Morrison, good morning, said the guard. Good to see you. The young lady will have to check her parcel. He had hoped for exactly this, that the big brown bag would prove a distraction, that his familiar backpack, rarely challenged, would not be challenged now. The young lady is carrying art supplies. Show him, Luann. And Luann, feigning resentment, pulled a sketch pad and pencils, turned the bag upside down. A paper clip fell onto the floor. She's going to copy a Rembrandt, Francis confided. Drawing a painting, it trains the hand. Nick turned his attention to the visitor behind them. Luann scraped up her tools. They trotted upstairs to the Rembrandts. Luann put some lines on paper. Then they trotted downstairs again to the members' lounge. From there they went to the trustees' rooms, and from there slipped down an out-of-the-way staircase to the basement, and then further to the basement of the basement. There stood a dozen lockers, a few closed and padlocked, the rest ajar. She helped him off with his backpack, as if it were an overcoat. Francis unzipped the pack. Luann withdrew the item without removing its bubble wrap. Francis slid it gently into a locker and closed the door. Luann took a padlock from her pocket, slipped it through matched metal loops, snapped it shut, and repocketed the key. Later, he figured she'd swallow it. No matter, the painting would escape from captivity in 10 years or maybe 15, whenever a committee of janitors determined that the locker was abandoned. The padlock would be forced open, the locker's secret brought to the director. A mild excitement would flutter the art world. Somebody would judge the painting authentic. Somebody else would declare it an anonymous donation. It would be hung on the wall of a numbered room. But first, it would be displayed in an exhibition of recent acquisitions. He'd mail her an invitation to the exhibition and a round-trip plane ticket. Now, following the girl up one stairway and the next, stopping for breath at each skimpy landing, he acknowledged that Luann might by that time have vanished into a dark corner of Moscow, he into the blinding fluorescence of a nursing home. Oh, well, ars longa, he said. She turned her head. Just a few more steps, she assured him. Thank you.
I don't know.
I'm Jana Malamud-Smith, and on behalf of my family, I want to thank you for coming this evening and join all the other thank yous being given to the board of Penn Faulkner and to Matt for hosting, and particularly I wanted to thank Deborah Tannen and the Penn Malamud Committee, and just for a minute to appreciate all the hours that are just so freely given to do the reading, to make the choice. It's such an act of generosity, and I really want us all to appreciate that together. This year is the 24th time we've given the Penn Malamud Award, and the world of my father, who died in March 1986, now seems long ago. Were he alive today, he would be 97 years old, a possible age, but not a likely one for a man born as World War I began. I sometimes wonder now what he would make of all that's happened politically, culturally, and all that's technologically transforming the world, particularly of books and publishing. Before he died, he helped us buy our first computer, but he never learned to use one. And he was dead before email or the internet or blogs or Twitter came into the world. He never even did a book tour. And I can barely imagine the unintentionally hilarious conversation that might have transpired had his slightly bullying publisher, Roger Strauss, ever suggested a Facebook page. I also wonder what he, a lifelong teacher of literature, would make of all the contemporary challenges to the worth of studying the liberal arts. Whoops, Dad, everything you devoted your whole life to is now deemed irrelevant. Interesting. My father attended City College in New York, which was free. A lucky thing. For many days, both he and his father had to scramble to come up with a nickel that let Dad pay for the long subway rides to class. While my grandfather wasn't thrilled when his firstborn announced he was going to become a writer, how ironic it is to think that thanks to excellent public education, this completely impoverished family could graduate a son from college debt-free, and thus able to risk choosing a life of writing and teaching, a life of intense hard work that would, for several decades, hold meager material reward. The absolute urgency to write and write and rewrite, to write every day, captured my father and held him for a lifetime. And he believed that narrative fiction was the only way for him to convey absolutely everything significant about life. From the time he was a young boy, he had spun tales to anyone who would listen, even as his father gruffly teased him for it. My father's storytelling came to mind again lately when I read a profile in the New York Times of a neurologist named Michael Gazzaniga. Thanks to machine imaging and careful experiments, Gazzaniga has determined that our brains act first and then create explanations of the actions afterwards. We all know that, but we prefer not to think about it. Courtesy of our left hemispheres, we rapidly create coherent or somewhat coherent retrospective accounts that we overlay upon our otherwise incoherent experience. In other words, at the center of our most critical brain function is a storyteller. And as described in the New York Times article, quote, "This storyteller never stops, except perhaps during deep sleep." This storyteller never stops. We are endlessly working to make sense of our experiences and to make meaning from them. Not a surprise, and yet in this time of enormous chaotic transition, it is delightfully reassuring. No matter what happens in the world, no matter how much it transforms, as long as there are people and as long as they are awake, the storyteller will never stop. Clay tablets will become papyrus, will become parchment, will become paper, will become e-books. Epic poems will become dramas, will become novels, will become blogs and movie scripts. But writers will endure, learning to craft and burnish narrative so that the stories they tell will allow readers simultaneously to see themselves more coherently and to see the world anew. In celebration of this fact, that the storyteller never stops, and that the best writers are storytellers extraordinaire, it gives me great pleasure tonight to give the 2001 Penn Malamud Award for Excellence in the Short Story to Edith Perelman.